Howdy, friends, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale, and joining me, as always, the troublemaker in this studio, Mr. Kyle Filson.
That's me, the troublemaker. How is everybody doing out there?
You notice, Kyle, I've got a lid on my Gatorade this time because we've almost knocked them over again. Just recently, we were in here monkeying around, and we had some tea glasses in here, and it got close to being a tragedy. So we've had to really, that's why I call him the troublemaker, because Kyle has reflexes like he was in the Matrix. Whenever he hits something, it's like he catches it magically before it lands. I'm like, good, I ain't seen you move that fast since like that buffet. I mean, he is juking.
It is remarkable that we have not spilt anything in here. I mean, seriously, almost 2 years we haven't spilled one thing.
You know we're going to ruin something next week just because you said that.
Precisely, yes,
yeah,
precisely.
It's going to be bad. It's going to be real bad. How you been, Brad? Good?
I've been good, man. My allergies have been beating me up this week, but besides that, it's been really good.
It happens. It happens. Folks, hope everybody's having a great time, had a wonderful weekend, had some fun. Maybe some people got to go to the lake, splash around, swim around. For everybody down there in Australia, hope you stayed warm. I got something I got to bring up.
Yeah, let's hear it.
This comes from The Independent, okay? This ain't funny at all. This is one of those things. I had a listener send me a little link to this, and this ain't cool, but the title is this: Death Metal Music Attracts Sharks, a documentary crew finds out.
Yeah. You don't think that?
I got two problems with this. First of all, I don't like the fact that this music attracts sharks, but second of all, I don't like the fact of who they played that they're calling death metal. I'm going to read this to you folks. It says a documentary film crew hit upon a novel technique to attract great white sharks. Doug Bolton wrote this. It says blasting death metal through an underwater speaker. The Discovery Channel crew filming for Shark Week show Bride of Jaws were on the hunt for a large great white, wonderfully nicknamed Joan of Shark.
It's a great name.
It's wonderful. It says, desperate to feature the 16-foot, 1.6-ton shark in their documentary, they submerged a speaker to see if the shark would react. Unfortunately, they didn't manage to attract Joan, but they did catch the attention of two others, one of which was 12 feet long. Now, sharks, they say here, by picking up vibrations. Now, we know that of the receptors and what it is, the Lorienzis, or is it the lamprey?
Yeah, on the nose, right?
Yeah, something in there. We're going to have to talk to Jason. I'm an idiot. I don't know. But here's what really gets me. It says, it's an odd tactic, but one that's apparently well known by shark hunters. Matt Waller, a shark tour operator in Australia, found out that AC/DC records cause sharks to change their behavior. They better not be calling AC/DC death metal. I mean, come on, that's just good.
Come on.
And they're Australian, too. So, I mean, that's even better. An Australian shark hunter's using Australian rock and roll?
Yeah, now, look, totally a great band. AC/DC is a great band. But it's rock and roll. I wouldn't call it death metal.
Yeah, and maybe they're just talking. They don't really go into what's talking. But apparently, they said that when you play the tunes from underwater speakers, that sharks swam straight up to the boat. And they brushed their heads against the diving cage, like straight towards the sound. I guess my question is it the music or is it the vibration?
Well, that's what, before you said AC/DC, I was thinking, is it a lot of those death metal bands have like a double bass drum?
Mm-hmm.
Is it that beat that's drawing them in?
They're going heels up,
really,
just rocking.
They should try some other types of music to really prove this theory, though.
Like the dubstep with a bunch of the bass drops and stuff?
Yeah, right. Play some pretty lights out there and see if they don't like that.
Well, because I'm wondering if it has to do with the beat. That's what I'm thinking.
It has to be, right?
With the vibration, because of the vibration, like what's given off. But anyway, I saw it. So it's just, and like they say, they think that it's because of the vibration, a low frequency, that it's more like a struggling fish. They don't know, but that's what they're believing right now. So we're all on the same page. But that's just one other reason. When I'm out in my kayak, I'm not going to be rocking out. You can't rock out. If you got to have your earbuds on, I don't need to be rocking out and some big megalodon come up and take a chunk out of my yak. I don't need that to be going on at all.
Moving on. Cam, you know how we talk about Hollow Earth and things like
that?
Did you see this? This is recent. This just came out about researchers have discovered an ocean 644 kilometers below the surface of our planet.
Really?
I had no idea. Check this out. After decades of theorizing and discussing possibilities, scientists report to finally having discovered a large ocean of water inside the mantle of Earth. They point out that it's a large water tank that could fill the oceans of the Earth three times. Now, this incredible discovery suggests that the surface water of the planet came from within the Earth as a part of a complete water cycle on the planet, instead of the theory that has been proposed that Earth was hit by icy comets that passed by millions of years ago, and that's what deposited water on the planet. So they found out that there's a large ocean of water inside the Earth. This is pretty cool. It says that the study was performed by researchers and geophysical scientists in the United States and Canada who used data obtained from the USA Array, which is a set of hundreds of seismometers located throughout the United States to consistently listen to the movements of the Earth's mantle and core. And they said they believe that the water on Earth may have come from within the planet and was pushed to the surface thanks to geological activity. According to the lead author of the study, Graham Pearson, who's a member of the University of Alberta, Canada, he says that this provides extremely strong confirmations that there are wet spots deep inside the Earth. The transition zone may contain as much water as all the oceans together. One reason why the Earth is a dynamic planet is the presence of water inside of it. The water changes depending on the way the world works. So that's pretty crazy. There's a large ocean deep in the Earth, 644 kilometers.
Yes.
And that's deep. I mean, they're saying there's enough water to fill up all the world's oceans three times. That's a lot of water, dude.
And that's got me thinking more and more about the whole hollow earth theory.
Exactly.
It's really
good. That's why I brought it up.
Yeah.
If there's ocean, I mean, okay. When they say ocean of water, I don't imagine you can, like, you know, drive around on it. It's in the soil and stuff, but it's still forced out by the seismic activity, geysers and things like that. It pushes it up. It's incredible.
It is. Dude, now I'm going to have to look more into the whole idea of hollow, I mean, even more so into hollow earth. Because when you said it, I didn't even think about it. I'm thinking of more of there's like a big ocean underwater.
Well,
it's like in a giant cave, there's a huge giant ocean.
I don't think it's like that. I mean, it could be.
I'm going to believe it is.
Describe
I just want to believe it is.
Doesn't describe in the article, you know, doesn't get into it that much.
Yeah.
But either way, pretty crazy.
Yes.
Well, staying with Canada, did you see this from CBC News? UFO sightings in Manitoba date back to 1792.
Whoa.
Now, just over 2,000 UFO sightings have been reported in Manitoba in the last 200 years. And a new report suggests that UFO sightings in Manitoba are older than the province itself. Now, Ufology Research, which is based in Winnipeg, I have friends that actually live in Winnipeg, says that there have been just over 2,000 reports of unidentified flying objects in Manitoba over the last 200 years. Now, Chris Rudkowski has been researching the phenomenon for more than 25 years and compiling an annual Canadian survey of all the sightings. Now, he says that records from the government and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and the United States show that Manitoba has a long history of sightings. It's not a recent phenomenon. It's not a phenomenon that has a product of television or the product of movies that are going on right now. These things go back quite a number of years. People have been fascinated with the things in the sky and are always wondering, are we alone in the universe? Now, they say that the earliest documented encounter cam came from 1792 from two explorers, David Thompson and Andrew Davy. Now, these two gentlemen were in the northern Manitoba, where they said they saw several bizarre meteors crash into the ice. Now, Thompson's diary details how the two were surprised one night by a brilliant meteor of globular-type form that appeared larger than the moon. It struck the river ice with a sound like a mass of jelly, was dashed into innumerable luminous pieces, and then instantly expired, the diary says. It says the next morning, we went to see what made these marks, and when they got there, they couldn't find anything. They didn't find one single particle of this crashed meteor, so experts think it was a UFO that they saw. And since that time, there's been numerous sightings. I mean, from recently even to this year, they said that even this year alone, that they've had like over 150 actual sightings in Manitoba. So it's not a new phenomenon. It's been going on there for a very long time. We'll have to ask Darren and Graham about it. I know Graham said he saw a UFO, but it was like in Israel, I think.
I'm still blown away by your very first statement that you have friends, much less that they're in Canada.
Right?
Yep.
I'm still blown. That's the part that I'm still hung up on. I'm going to have to go back and read up what you were talking
about.
I don't
have very many. That's the problem.
Oh, I know.
You see, he used to live here, and they moved back to Winnipeg.
Yeah, you've driven him off. You've
played
driven
hockey
him.
With him a couple times, and then he was out.
He's like, I'm done. I'm out of here.
Take off, eh?
Folks, you should have heard him working on all of his Canadian accent. He's always messing around with that stuff. So, yeah, I've always got to make him not do it, because I'm like, come on. Now,
oh, the Canadian stuff?
Yeah.
Well, it's because I played ice hockey for so long. I mean, I know a lot of Canadian people.
Yeah.
So.
All right, folks. So we're going to take us a little break. And when we come back from that, we're going to be discussing the moon-eyed people and the Cherokee stories and kind of kick around a little history with that right there. So stick around. We're gonna try to blow your minds open a little bit more this afternoon or this morning or whenever you're listening to us. We're just going to have a little fun. So y'all take care. We'll see you on the other side.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Hope everybody enjoyed those stories. Cam, a couple of days ago, you were talking to me on one of our show notes, you know, episodes. We get these meetings together, me and you, off air. And we discussed the kind of things we're going to be talking about in the next show. And you were telling me this story, and it's really interesting, and I find it fascinating, about this Native American story, about this group of people that lived in this area before they even did, and the unique characteristics about these people.
Mm-hmm.
Could you fill me and the listeners in on what you found?
Yeah.
So I love these kind of stories. It always gets my head spinning because I've never heard of it. You know, whenever you hear about something new, then it's going to drive me crazy. And like once you learn it, you can never unlearn it.
Yeah.
So I'm fascinated by these stories.
I'll tell you what sent me down this path. I was looking into, we've done a lot of stuff on pre-Columbian history. I was going to do a little in-depth thing on the Prince Murdoch theory, on the fact of him discovering North America. And one thing led to another, and I came across this word, and this word is Azgen, A-Z-G-E-N, Azgen, and it's called the Moon-Eyed People. And so I had to look into this. Well, they've been written about in books that date all the way back to 1797. It was written in a book by Mr. Benjamin Smith Barton, and he explained some stuff in there a little bit about the Moon-Eyed People.
The Moon-Eyed People, that's interesting. Moon-Eyed,
yeah. And then it was also written about in Alan Eckert's book, The Frontiersman. And he actually, there's a quote I'll read you the quote that comes out of that book. Now, some people say it's been fictionalized, that this quote's not a legit thing. But there is a lot of, I guess, evidence or more of like an ample evidence of in these oral traditions that this has been something that really happened, that really took place. And when I say what really happened, it's not anything crazy. I don't want to get carried away. I don't want people to start thinking, you know, this is another, like a hidden war or this is thing really wild. This is just a neat little part of an oral tradition that I found entertaining. And then it kind of tied into a few things while I was thinking about it. But basically, the Moon-Eyed People they're traditionally spoken of in the Cherokee tribes, are the people that kind of first started talking about it in the way that they found it. And you think about it, the Cherokee that discuss this talk about them being moon-eyed and light-skinned, very light-skinned, almost albino-like, if not albino. And then that's funny because if you look into a lot of the pre-Columbian stories, they talk about these white people. And, you know, when we think of white people, we think of Caucasian. But what if it was way more white? What if they were even more than what we would normally perceive?
And they call them moon-eyed because?
Well, they had large eyes, too. And basically, they could only see at night. Some of them were even known to be blind, is the way some of the story goes. Let me read you this right quick here. This, like I said, comes from the book The Frontiersman, and it's Blackfish, the Shawnee chief, said, "The Shawnees cannot tell you that you are allowed to settle in the Kentucky lands. We have never owned that land. It belongs to the ghosts of murdered Azgins, a white people from an eastern sea. Their bones and ghosts own and occupy every hill and valley of that country. They protect the game there and have more and better right there than any of the Indian tribes, including our own Shawnee Nation, because they do not need or use material food for themselves, and they do not like it."
Long ago, our fathers and our grandfathers killed off the Asgans, but we now fear more the spirits of these people than our fathers and grandfathers feared them when they were flesh. It says Blackfish paused, and there was a murmur and a head shake and nodding all around from the group he was speaking to. And he continued, when our food is all gone and our squaws and children starving, we appeal to the ghosts of the white mothers who were killed there. And by saying the right words, we are allowed to kill an elk or deer or bear or buffalo. But, he slowly chanted down, but things have changed. We are never allowed to kill the game wantonly, and we are forbidden to settle in the country of Kentucky. And if we did, the ghosts would not rise from their caves and mounds and slay us, but they would set father against son and son against father and neighbor against neighbor and make them kill one another. Now, that's a pretty unique little thing there, don't you think?
Yeah, that's interesting.
That's the story that he was telling. Well,
he's so, Asgan.
So you, but he talks about the thing that I got confused is he was like a white people from an eastern sea.
Yeah, to me that sounds like explorers.
Exactly. Now you know that when we've discussed on the show that there's a lot of, I guess, mumbling in the back. Basically, of we've heard stories and tell that there was a war that took place here before. The Spanish, before people really started knowing about this, before the alleged, you know, before Columbus made it popular and more people found out about it, that they were people visiting here for hundreds of years before that, if not thousands of years before that. And there was wars and things and people fighting over it. So we know that maybe this could have been something else. What's funny to me, though, is that there's all these strange stories of this possible strange people or hominids that are always up in this Appalachian area up through the United States. And long before European colonization, like we're talking about, way before that. But it's just funny that this is another one of those that ties into it. But apparently there was a Spanish conquistador named Panfilio de Navarrez in 1500 AD. And he wrote that the Cherokees say that when they first arrived in the country they now inhabit, they found it possessed by certain moon-eyed people who could not see in the day. Now, that's a strange thing to come from that much. 1500s is when it comes from that much. So they've told him the same story, but that they couldn't see during the day.
But that's what I find fascinating about the story, not, you know, among other things, is the fact that the people are blind during the daytime, but they can see at night.
Yeah.
Is there an actual condition that is like that? I mean, is that even possible?
Maybe the pigmentation of an eye, if you were an albino, if you had the non-pigmentation of the eye, I guess. I'm guessing. I have no idea. I have no clue. You know, maybe it makes, you know, it's like it may be hard to see because it's too bright. And at night you can see because it's not as bright, I guess. I don't know. And would it be the pigmentation of the eyeball itself or the skin around the eye?
Yeah, it makes me think of, now I don't know, but my visualization, I'm picturing these people that live underground. Like they're coming out of hollow earth.
Well, it talks about some of that.
Kind of like the ant people or something. You know, you've seen on these nature shows like crickets or salamanders and stuff that live in this subterranean world where it's constantly black. They actually become like almost white or clear.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm picturing in my mind is at night these moon people come out of the ground. And
come out of their caves or something like that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
well, there was another, get a load of this, Alvar Nuñez was another fellow that was on the same expedition that Panfilio was on, okay?
Okay.
Not Navarez. This is a Nuñez guy. Now, he was on it, and he actually did a little writing himself. And in part of the writing that he wrote, it says, some of the Indians brought many people before us, the greater part whereof were squint-eyed, and others of the same people are blind, whereat we greatly marveled. They were well set and of good behavior and whiter than all the rest that we had seen until then. So he's even speaking of the fact that they were extremely light-skinned compared to everybody else and everything else that they had seen, and they were squinting and even blinded.
Yeah, that's, well, you know, and I'm not to sound incredibly racist, but could the squinted have been Chinese or Japanese explorers?
But why would they be so light-skinned?
I have no idea.
See, there's so many. Well, you don't know exactly. There's too many things. I also like the fact, too, that they talk about that Kentucky was a sacred land and was off limits to everybody. Because what's funny is, I even looked into this, there's even some history of some of the Ohio tribes in that area talking about how Kentucky was sacred and off limit to everybody. And the Indians, they said they could hunt Kentucky, but they weren't allowed to make it a permanent settlement, that it was more of a preserve to them in their traditions.
Really?
Now, that's kind of wild too, right?
It is.
So is it one and the same? Is it something that they passed on to somebody, or did they tell them? I guess what I'm saying is, were they telling them this to keep them out, or were they telling this because they really believed that? But when I told you about the Barton character, and then Benjamin Barton, that he wrote his book, well, I'm going to read you a little part of that right quick, and I want you to get a kick out of this, from 1797, and it says, this is Barton, it says, the Cherokees tell us that when they first arrived in the country, they found it possessed by certain moon-eyed people whom they expelled. That they beat back, which is much like the stories go with the giants also.
Mm-hmm.
The moon, but it's much with the giants getting pushed back and kicked out of there too. The invading Cherokee found white people near the head of the Little Tennessee with forts extending down the Tennessee as far as Chickamauga Creek, elsewhere, and through Kentucky and western Tennessee, the white race was extended into. And they also talk about their houses as small circular structures of upright logs covered with earth. Well, now that goes to more sounding more like another tribe of people.
Yeah, exactly.
Not maybe like a hominid, but more of a tribe of people than that. So then that's where I guess how I got led into it with the Marduk, the Prince Marduk thing. Because are we talking about what you and I have discussed with the Welsh Indians? Is this what we're getting into?
The Mandans,
yes.
Right?
Is that kind of what we're going to get into now? You know, I don't, like I said, this is one of those things I'm kind of just going along with because I'm so blown away by this whole thing. Is this was never discussed. Is this another race or another, I guess you can't say species, but I guess you could. Is this another offshoot like the giants? Were these another group of people that were here that have been covered up? Maybe they were, of course, if they were much like us, only in appearance, we wouldn't be able to tell in their bones, I'm sure. But I don't know. Now, listen to this here. You're going to, the Cherokee state that the stone earthwork atop Fort Mountain in Georgia is a remnant of a war between the Asgan and the Cree Indians, and that the Asgan lost the war and moved north, deeper into the mountains, and that's there when they begin to live in a subterranean environment.
Yeah, see, that's what I'm talking about. See, subterranean environment. That's what it sounds like,
yes,
to me. You got these almost like albino people that are tall. They kind of remind me even of the Nordics. You hear these Nordic mm-hmm. extraterrestrials, and they can't see during the daytime. They can see at night. They live subterranean caves or wherever they live like that. I mean, that's insane. It reminds me a lot of the stories of the ant people that mm-hmm. you see out in the southwestern
area. And I did
area.
The stories on some of the ant people. We've discussed it. Yeah.
Right.
Well, here's another part of this legend. It says the Cherokee drove the Asgan out of their village, away from their village, to the mouth of Peachtree Creek near present Murphy, North Carolina. And the Asgan fled then into Tennessee. So they're pushing them back out. It's it all just like with the giants. They're pushing them out. Now, they say that Fort Mountain, this is part of the other stuff that I've read into, like I was just telling you, the earthworks up there. Apparently, in their traditions, or what they claim the stories that they tell, is the second of these three forts, or these earthworks that were, like I said, constructed by the Asgans. There's also one near DeSoto Falls, Alabama. Then, like I told you, Fort Mountain, Georgia. And then Old Stone Fort near Manchester, Tennessee. Is said to have that's what the natives say is part of the Asgan, I guess you could say, people are there. That's what used to be. That was their forts that they had built. The natives didn't build it. So then it starts making me wonder. My mind starts racing back into it makes me think about Cahokia. It makes my mind drift back to Cahokia when we've talked about that.
Yeah.
Was the Asgan people part of the people that built Cahokia?
It could be.
I mean, and then the natives. I don't, there's so much to this that I wish there was more to it. And like you talked about the Mandan Indians, some, even according, like, I guess it's to the interpretation, they say that the Mandan were actually descendants of the Asgan.
Right. That's what I'm saying. It would make sense if there was this other race
mm-hmm.
that was living there, that they were slowly, you know, interbreeding with the Native mm-hmm. Americans at the time. And that's what created the Mandans, which were blonde hair, blue eyed.
Exactly.
Native Americans. that lived in that area of the United States. I mean, that's it's incredible. Like, I've heard of those stories. I've never heard of the Moon-Eyed People, yeah, or these Asgans.
Yes.
I've never heard of this. That's what surprised me. You know, just when you think you know everything about the history, you learn something new. I've never heard of this.
And it made me look, because I was like, well, what did they, when they start saying moon-eyed, so I went to digging and trying to find more, if it was really all about size, or if it was really about that they could only see at night, or if it, you know, what it was moon-eyed. And what I could really find, the main thing that I nailed down, was the Cherokee. There was part of their legend that said that the moon-eyed people, the Asgan, were light-skinned and blue-eyed.
Yeah, see?
Now, the blue, I don't understand why blue-eyed meant moon-eyed, unless maybe it was lost in translation.
Could have been.
Okay, I don't know that. Until I found this, doing a little bit more research into the whole albinism and things. There's a tribe in Panama and Colombia, but Panama is where this mainly originates from, is the Kuna tribe, or Guna, depends on how you want to pronounce it. There's an extremely high incident rate of albinism in their tribe. And when I say that, I say what I had found was one.
Currently,
one in every 145 babies born into that tribe are born albino.
Really?
Yes.
That's probably the highest amount of any group on the planet, right?
As far as I can find, yes. Now, in their mythology, they were given, those people are given an extremely special place in their culture because they are considered a very special race of people.
Right.
And I want you to listen to this.
Okay.
They have the specific duty of defending the moon.
What?
Yeah.
Now, that's what they believe?
Now, why does this tie in? I don't. The moon-eyed people, and then all of a sudden, now we're talking about this group of being the people, the moon-eyed. But they, in their culture, they believe that on certain occasions at night, basically during lunar eclipses, that there's a dragon, a dark dragon comes out, tries to eat. Now, this is, of course, old tradition, comes out and tries to devour the moon. The only people that can go outside at night are the albino, and they are the only ones allowed on those nights to go outside during lunar eclipses and to defend the moon, to shoot down the dragon with, they say, specially made bow and arrows.
Wow.
The tie together right there is what blew me away. I'm like, okay, I'm more natives, because, you know, you look at the natives people down in Panama, down in Colombia, down in South America, could easily be kinfolks, could easily be descendants of the Cherokee or whatever, as they work down. Like, well, you know, they believe, like we've discussed, that they may be a Mayan tie to Georgia. Well, now you're getting right in there to where they're talking about being in Georgia, where they're talking about the Asgan people. We're talking about, so if there's a tie there, there could be a tie from the tip of North America to the tip of South America of these descendants of these people. They still in the same culture. We're still talking about that, but it still ties into the moon-eyed people. But the blonde-haired and blue-eyed, that's the thing that gets me the most, is blonde-haired. Because, I mean, I guess, You look it up, you see a lot of the people that are born with albinism, lots of times they don't have like a distinct hair color or eye color. You know, it's very, very light. I didn't understand it, and I still don't. I'm still caught up in the fact of if it's lost in translation or if it's truly this, if it's truly they are blue-eyed, if it is part of a Welsh contact, if it's proof of that.
I know what you're saying, and I agree with you. This happens from time to time when it has to do with an ancient culture and their traditions, especially their oral traditions. Are these oral traditions real? Do they have any sustenance to them? Or are they simply urban legends of that time?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You got to remember, just because it's an old tale doesn't necessarily mean that it's ironclad 100% true.
Exactly. You're right.
Human beings make up urban legend stories nowadays, like the Slender Man and things like that. They could have done the same thing then. Maybe some elders told to these people. Is it real? I don't know. It reminds me a lot of this new book I'm reading, and it's written by Nick Redfern, of course, The Bloodline of the Gods. Mm-hmm. There's this special group of people, like he says, 10 to 15% of the people walking around on the planet aren't really like the other people.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do with this special bloodline, this Rh bloodline.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most rare type of blood type you can have. And I've often thought about that. We've talked about it before. I mean, why are we all the same species, but we have different blood types? That's bizarre to me.
It is very strange, yeah.
Right?
It is completely crazy.
So it makes me think of things like that. Are these Asgans, are they truly a different species? Are these leftover, this precursor that's on your DNA that causes this albino thing to show up from time to time, is that an ancient race, a different race, much like the Native Americans believed?
Well, the first thing I went to looking into, and as I was like, I wonder if there was any families, like, is there any albino families You know, can it be passed on? You know, could like a husband and wife have albino children? And it was funny because, I mean, I punched it in and just messing around. And I came upon a story on a Lon Strickler's website. And it's by Chris Holly. And it is a very strange tale. Now, Chris wrote years ago a tale from the 1960s when he lived on Long Island about an albino family. And it was really interesting because it was backed up later by somebody that just out of the blue emailed him and talked to him about it. But I'm going to read you this story. Now listen to this. This is pretty cool. It says, years ago, I was sitting on my deck with my mother having lunch when my mother looked over at me and said, "Remember the albino family that used to live in our area that always shopped at Gert's department store?" Says, I hadn't thought about Gert's department store, which had long ago gone out of business, for years, much less the albino family. My mother went on about how striking they were and how well-dressed and groomed they were. My mother commented many times when she saw them how beautiful the family was and always noticed what they were wearing. I never thought much about it then as I was in my teens, but as my mother went on and on about the albino family, I realized how very strange they really were. The family consisted of two adults and three children. All of them were albinos. I have only seen a few other people who have had this albino condition and really did not note the differences in this family and the other albinos I have seen. Talking to my mother about this family, I began to realize that they were truly unusual people and not like other albinos. Now get a load of this, gal. The five members of this family were all 6 foot in height, including the mother and daughter. The male members stood between 6 foot three and to 6 foot five. They were extremely tall people. When they walked through the department store, they stood a head above most other shoppers. Each of them had thick, full, pure white hair. They were beautiful people with high cheekbones and straight model-like features. Their skin was white. Pure white. They all had the same color eyes, which were clear, big, and very light blue. They kept to themselves. They would stay together when they shopped and seemed to be quiet and polite people. It wasn't until years later and I had that conversation with my mother about the family that I realized that they were a very different group of people. I thought about the possibility of two beautiful albino people who looked so much alike in height, looks, and facial features meeting and marrying. Although this is possible, I knew the odds had to be nearly impossible. I then recalled reading an article while in college in the late 1970s that talked about all the eye problems that went hand in hand with those who were albinos. I also read that eye color for the typical albino runs towards the pinkish-reddish tint. I know that they are degrees of the condition which would have a lesser or greater effect on things like eye color and skin color or lack of it. Now, in those who were albinos, I did not read that any had clear, big, blue eyes. As I tried to find out if they were blue-eyed albinos that could run in an entire family, but came up empty-handed in my search. I'm not qualified to answer the question to the chance of this happening, but feel it best, it would be a very rare occurrence. I thought about this family and had to admit that finding two tall, beautiful, blue-eyed albinos who married and had three tall, beautiful, blue-eyed children were either an incredible happening or that they were not a family of albinos. Years after discussing this family with my mother, I came across a few articles on the internet that talked about the tall whites. I was scrolling down one of the pages of the site and looking at it when I came across an artist rendition of the alien species called the tall whites, or the Nordics. Now he goes on and talks about a few other things, but it made me think instantly when he got into that, about the whole deal with the Nordics, but it's still the whole eye color. It's funny that it goes back to that blue eye. So now what I'm guessing I'm putting out there is, were the Asgians, is it an alien race of Nordics that had moved in here? Was that what this was?
Yeah,
they were
right.
Talking about
that,
their height.
That description sounds exactly like these moon-eyed people they were just talking about.
Now, none of these stories from the 1500s and all that with these explorers talk about the height of these albino people. But they do talk that they... Now, of course, these people sound like they could see during the day. The woman that actually emailed him said she was walking her dog on the beach, and there was a family that she remembers from the 60s that lived in that area running along the beach. If you couldn't see, you're not going to be running along a beach during the day. I get that part. I totally get that. I'm just throwing it out there. So what is it? Is this another one of those stories that ties into... either a different species, like we've discussed, either more along the species of giants that we've talked about in North America, or is it more along the species of the little people that we've talked about, and that the Cherokee have a lot of legends about the little people, which we're probably going to get into, you know, in the next few weeks coming up, or are these extraterrestrials?
I don't know, man. To me, it just sounds like a different race of people. That pre-existed in early North America for who knows how long, that the Native Americans knew about them. They created their own stories about them, their own legends, their own mythos about them. I mean, maybe, you know, a lot of it's not sure. Those are awkward people. I mean, anytime you get a separation and, you know, two distinct different colors of pigment in people's skins, I mean, people are going to create all kinds of stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that could be what it is. But what I did like is the similarities with those people. With the being tall, being very white, and the blue eyes, not pinkish or red like most albinos have, sounds exactly like these moon-eyed people.
It's a strange.
Maybe it is still going on. To me, I picture like an odd thing that's very quiet. You know, they're all very. I don't know. It's almost like Men in Black.
Yeah.
Like when I think of these stories of these crazy, I think of the Men in Black.
Exactly.
Right, because they always act a little odd. They always seem to be very pale.
Very well dressed. Very well groomed.
Yeah, and I mean they wear sunglasses, so you couldn't see if they had these blue eyes.
I don't know.
It's interesting, man. It drives me crazy when I learn new stuff like this, because now I want to know more. And the sad thing is, there's just not a whole lot on the internet.
I spent a lot of time going through a lot of stuff, and it all ends to the same spots. It just kind of dead ends. It was a few of these little tales on it, but I mean, really, from that long ago. And from what it is, you're not going to get much from it except their stories. I mean, that's it. I guess I just don't understand the stories of why Native Americans. And like I said, if this is true, maybe this story is being told by other explorers and the Native Americans never really said this.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe they just like to promote the fact that, oh, white people were here doing all this before. I don't know that. I have no idea. No way of knowing. But it is awful strange to me that the Cherokee, if they told this story, if this story was true in their traditions, that they were like, well, those three settlements there aren't ours, and we don't go to Kentucky. Kentucky. We don't go there. And those three settlements were Asgian people. They weren't ours. But then we ended up going down there and putting a beating on them and running them off. And now they've moved, and now they've gone subterranean. And then that's kind of where the whole thing stops. I don't know. It just sounds strange. And then it even goes, like I said, back to the 1500s. I mean, you start talking about the 1700s and things like that. I mean, we have quotes and things that come from times, but you start going back into the 1700s and then back to the I don't know, man. It was one of those strange things that we may never know. I just brought up because I was so fascinated by this that I just kind of want to bring everyone to get everybody's ideas on it. I don't understand it. That's a little bitty thing I'd never heard of till, like I said, the Prince Marduk kind of led me down the fact of these Mandans, and then it kind of turned into this.
Man, that is insane. Well, thank you so much for sharing that story with us. Well, we're going to take a break, and stick around, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Folks, hope you enjoyed that. I enjoyed the heck out of looking into that, and I don't know. I'm still lost. I still go back and read the stuff, and I don't know. It's one of those things that it's going to pick on me for a while. But here's what's wild, folks. We've been talking off air, and you know, me and Kyle been going through all this thing, and he brought up something that I didn't even know he was looking this up. You and I had talked about this literally 6 months ago because we had seen something about it. I forgot if it was on television or on what it was. And you brought it up to me, and I'm like, yeah, I've always wondered about that. Tell them what we've been talking about. Go ahead. If you got it, throw it out there. Let's let them hear this.
I was talking about this possible urban legend, which I think is what it mostly seems like, about these melon heads. You know, everybody knows what these are, I think.
Yeah.
If you don't, they're hairless, deformed bodies. They have like razor sharp teeth. They have disturbing eyes. And of course, they have a huge melon like head.
Like much like myself.
Right. And there's been sightings of these things. And there's been all kinds of accounts that have been told about that they're cannibalistic, that they live in the wild. They live in the woods, much like these hermits that live in the woods. And that, you know, if you go walking along these certain paths, that they'll get you. Now, they're only in a few areas. They're either in Michigan, Ohio, Connecticut, and they've even been seen in Germany and England before, which I find weird is that they're on, you know, two different continents.
And I don't remember, what, like I said, what got us going. It may have been the whole urban legend thing, because we've talked about really digging into some of those, too.
Yeah, because they're fascinating to hear, and I like to bring some of these forward. But, I mean, they're really... Some of them are totally unsubstantiated.
I mean,
you have no idea other than people's word of mouth. But, you know, it does seem that a lot of people talk about these things. Now, the beginnings of these melon heads, it has a couple different stories even there based on the region. Like the story in Michigan is completely different than the story of Ohio and completely different than the one that takes place in Connecticut. This first one, though, let's get into it. This is the one that takes place in Ohio. A mysterious man, known only as Dr. Crow, lived in a secluded house on Wisner Road in Kirtland, Ohio, which is a suburb of Cleveland. Some say he was married and that his wife was unable to have children. Other accounts say that Crow's had a child who suffered from hydrocephalus, which is water on the brain, which caused the youngster to be severely disfigured. Dr. Crow may not have been a real doctor, or he may have been stripped of his medical license, but that didn't stop him from his work. He was said to be the guardian of a number of orphaned children, or perhaps he was the staff physician, although there are no records of any orphanage ever being in the area. In either case, the children became the victims of his macabre medical practices. Possibly in an attempt to help his own child, or maybe in some sort of quest for a cure, Dr. Crow performed experiments on the children. Horrific, painful experiments, including injecting fluid into their heads. The repeated treatments caused the malformations that gave the children their terrifying appearance. Years passed, and Dr. Crow's insanity raged. The escalating evil spilled out from the doctor to his patients. The children, those who survived, went mad. In an unexpected act of revolt, the melon heads attacked Crow, taking vengeance in his most violent manner. The doctor died at the hands of his own children, who are now free from collective captivity. The melon heads set fire to the doctor's house and laboratory, destroying any and all records of the non-sanctioned experiments and deplorable abuse. They were free, but where could they go? The only home they had ever known was gone, as was the only adult they had ever dealt with. The melon heads took to the woods, hiding together, scared, angry, seeking shelter and food wherever they could find it. They had no ability or desire to communicate with the outside world. Once again, they were alone. Now, that's just one story of how these melon heads came to be. And another version of the story is almost the opposite. It paints a different picture of Dr. Crow, and it says instead of a mad scientist inflicting horrible abuse on these orphans, Crow was a gentle, loving man, seeking only to help children suffering from hydrocephalus. Maybe because of his personal history, maybe out of the goodness of his heart. Crow took in dozens of orphaned, abandoned, and unwanted children, giving them safe and secure place to call home. The melonheads, as ignorant neighbors called them, loved the good doctor. He was like a father who gave them unconditional love and acceptance. In his secluded hideaway on Wisner Road, Dr. Crow cared for the unfortunate children, shielding them from the cruelty of the outside world. All was well for the unusual family until the aging Dr. Crow suddenly died of natural causes. Now, upset and frightened, with no one to take care of them, no one to feed or clothe them, the melon heads became enraged. They set fire to the house, burned Dr. Crow's body, and fled to the woods. As they took their anger out on anyone who crossed their paths, the locals knew too far to stay away from the old Crow property. but other curiosity seekers went looking for trouble. As the years passed, the melonheads grew. The ones who survived reproduced, creating more deformed offspring. The insanity was passed as well as the physical characteristics. Now, to me, I mean, it seems like a fantastical tale, right?
It is an amazing tale.
Right. I think too amazing. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah.
I'm bringing it up simply because it's an interesting story. I don't believe that it has any sustenance. I don't think it's real. It sounds like an urban legend. Now, they've been spotted other places, like I said. And in Connecticut, they have a different story. They talk about that this Trumbull area of Connecticut, the family there was practicing witchcraft. And this was during the same times as the Salem witch trials. And, of course, these people were banned from town. And since they were banned from town, they were no longer able to go into town to meet or mingle with people. So they began interbreeding. And because of all this interbreeding and these satanical, you know, satanic rituals they were doing, they started having these deformities to their children. And then they became melonheads, or like that's what the people call them. And now they live in the woods there. And
because they
people.
Didn't want to walk in the town. So they just like, hey, let me catch my sister.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. You know,
that's great.
Other people say that there's nothing wrong with them. It was just a natural birth defect and that they might have been mentally deranged. And of course, they lived in the wild and people made up stories because, you know, even as far back as only like 60, 70 years ago, I don't think people really understood these diseases like, you know, cerebral palsy and afflictions that people have that we understand how to correct and autism, severe autism that people know how to deal with nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 70 years ago, they would just throw them in like an asylum, you mm-hmm. know, and literally not work with them. They didn't know what to do with them. So you could imagine if there was somebody that had an affliction like that, mm-hmm. that the locals would make up these stories. Oh, yeah, he's a cannibal and he'll kill you, you know.
Yeah, gets a little carried away.
He gets carried away. That's what I think it is. There are some stories similar to those that take place in Hertfordshire, England, but it's basically the same kind of things. To me, it seems like urban legend at its finest. I mean, to me, because there's no trace of any of this orphanage surviving or mm-hmm. being there. There's no trace of this Dr. Crow, they're saying. So, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, it does smell a little fishy, doesn't it?
Yeah.
A little bit like BS.
I think it's a good story to tell around Halloween if you live in Ohio or Connecticut or Michigan.
And you're going
to
be driving
to young kids. And you're, right, you go down these old roads.
There's a melon head.
Watch out, there's a melon head.
I got you, yeah.
But it doesn't seem real to me.
Well, it is strange. It makes you wonder, like you said, is it based in some sort of reality? Is it based in some sort of truth? Much like some of the stories that I did earlier. Is it based in some sort of truth? Is that where some of this comes from?
Could be. Maybe it was an extraterrestrial. You know, the giant heads. You've seen those. I mean, they've talked about extraterrestrials having giant heads. Yeah,
maybe. There's so much. I mean, that's why I love, even though a lot of it's all unsubstantiated, the stories are still the best. Because you always makes you what if. Because, I mean, it's hard to say that, you know. There has to be some thread there. There has to be something that kind of gets it going. I don't know about you. I don't know anybody that would just sit around and go, I'm just going to make up the fact that I think I saw a guy in a suit with a giant deformed head. And then when somebody asks me where I think he comes from, I'm going to make up a story that he was raised in an orphanage by a crazy doctor. I mean, I don't know if anybody's going to sit around and go to that much trouble just to tell a story to a friend and then hope and all good and intent that it spreads around the world and other people see these melon heads too.
Yeah.
Well, or was it made up? And it's much like what we talked about with Slender Man. Is it one of those things? Have we built it now? Have us talking about it and everybody really focusing on it and people have started seeing it. Are they really seeing it or have we created it?
I don't know. But I disagree with you. And I think some kids could possibly make up a story like that. I bet Stephen King would tell wild stories as a 12-year-old.
I don't know if he would go into the in-depth stuff and then carry on. That's the thing.
Well, there's these stories like this exist in every small town across the world, and some of them stick and gain traction, some don't, I guess.
That's true.
Either way, you know, I know for weeks people have been emailing us wanting us to talk about it. There's nothing really there. I mean, you can get on the internet. There's probably 100 websites dedicated to the stuff, but there's no real stories. It's just the same old history stories, like I told you about the Dr. Crow or the insane asylum. There's no like, hey, August 2013, me and my wife were driving home from Outback Steakhouse down What's and What's Road, and then all of a sudden we were attacked by melonheads. They chewed the side view mirrors off my car, you know, and they took our 2-year-old out the back window and ate him.
Yeah.
And we had to watch. I mean, there's no stories like that. There's
not like Bigfoot sightings or giant bird sightings or thunderbirds. It's nothing like that.
If there are, then I couldn't find them because that's what I was hoping. I was hoping I could give a history and then also give some sightings of these things. Mm-hmm. I couldn't come up with any sightings.
Dang.
I mean, a couple blogs had some people, but it's kind of like the creepypasta stuff where you can tell it's probably just some guy up late one night making up a story that him and his brother-in-law Jack saw it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
I got you.
But speaking of something, I'd like to give a quick shout-out real quick. I was just busy last night reading this new book, and it's a fantastic book. Now, you know me and Cam, we read tons of books, and we get tons of books. I mean, literally, how many books you think we get a month shipped to us?
I don't even want
to
know. Yeah.
25? 30, yeah, maybe? And so there's a ton of reading to do. And, of course, you know, we don't read every one of them front to back, but there's a lot of reading that takes place. But every once in a while, you get a new one, and it's completely different than what you expect. And those are the ones that I really like. And I was reading one of these that happened to be last night. It's called A Trojan Feast. And it's by Joshua Cutchin. And this book is really cool. It talks about the food and drink offerings of aliens, fairies, and Sasquatch. Now, I'm telling you, I've never read any book like this. It's really interesting. And he's already agreed to come on the show. So he's going to be on in a couple weeks. And we're going to talk to him about it. I think he was on Micah's show recently. But, you know, the book details and outlines these correlations between, like, fairies. You know, we're... As far as I know, we do more fae stories than any other show that I know of.
I'm a fae junkie.
I love them, too. All these connections between, like, extraterrestrial abductions and these fairies' abductions almost seem very similar. And just to give you a snippet, I'm going to tell you one story that's in this book, and it actually, it's pretty cool. Now, this story is an unsettling story about a family who got more than they bargained for while on vacation in an Oregon cabin in July of 1997. Now, it says early into their trip, their youngest daughter, 8, her name was Violet Bredlow. She disappeared in the forest. When they found her, she claimed that she had been carried through the air by some unseen friends. Now, that evening, Violet prepared 2 plates of leftovers, telling her family that if they weren't fed, they would become angry and force the family to leave. The mother was informed that the friends who had carried Violet through the forest were actually 2 little people and had requested that they receive the family scraps in the storage room of the cabin. The girl said that the men refused to eat while anyone was watching, so after she had placed the plates on the floor, she and her mother left, the door slamming shut of its own accord behind them. Now startled, the mother immediately went in to look inside the room and only saw 2 rats feasting on the leftovers. Now, Violet contended that they were not rats, but tiny men with wrinkled faces who were talking inside of her head. Now, Violet's evening ritual continued until her father one night set a rat trap. The mother was shocked to hear the snap of metal one evening and screams from her daughter, who claimed that her mental link with the little people made her feel their pain. The mother rushed to the sprung trap in the storage room and saw, to her amazement, a small man in green trying to free the foot of another tiny entity. The mother pried the rat trap open and the men took off, cursing. Now, the next couple days, their house began to be overrun with rats and vermin, thus successfully driving the Bredlows out of the cabin. Is that not a crazy story?
That is insane. I love it.
The book is filled with stuff like that.
Oh, that is insane.
And this was in 1997. A little man. These fairy stories. They talks about all these stories of, like, you know, the fae always try to give you some wine or some bread. Mm-hmm. Don't eat the food that the fairies offer you.
It's because they're real. They're real.
It's incredible.
They're there. I think they're around us all the time. We just don't see them.
Like I said, if you want to get a jump start on this, you can buy the book now. It's called A Trojan Feast, and it's by Joshua Cutchin. Like I said, he's going to come on the show. I can't wait to have that discussion with him. Pretty cool. Cam?
Yes, sir.
What's going on in your world, man? What do you got planned for this week?
Nose to the grindstone, working on videos.
Oh, yeah, I gotcha.
I'm going to be working at my regular job, my other job. I'm going to be working like crazy. And then get home and work on some more videos, work on some more YouTube stuff. I want to, like we've been talking to folks about doing some documentary stuff. We're working towards that. We're working towards getting where we're going to start filming some things and going out and actually piling up some maybe 30 or 45 minute little mini docs or so, you know, kind of like we do the shows. We're going to pick some stuff that we're going to do them over, and we're going to actually go and sit down and do some interviews and film the people and film some stuff. And that's about it. That's what I'm going to be working on this whole week. Not the documentary yet, just building for it.
That's right. Don't forget, folks, if you like Expanded Perspectives and would like to help out, please go to iTunes, rate and write us a review. We can see already that those numbers are growing over there.
Oh, people have been knocking them down. We're getting closer. We're trying to hit 200
very, very close
in America.
In America, yeah.
We're trying to hit 200 before the two-year mark. And I would love to be able to tell you exactly how many episodes this is going to be, but we're getting real close to 100 right now. And the two-year mark will be, I want to say September 14th, I believe, is the two-year mark.
Somewhere around then. Yeah, we actually need to pay attention before we go blowing by it like we did on the Elite Show. I think somebody, Kevy Kev, congratulated us on 50 episodes.
Yeah, we shot right by there.
Once again, I was like, we're not even aware of that. You just get busy working and you just don't look up.
I'm sorry.
It happened, it went by. We never mentioned it.
Not intelligent. I'm not intelligent.
If you've had any melonhead sightings of your own, please email the show or any stories.
Fae folk. Anybody that's had any dealing with Fae folk.
I love them. You can email the show, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. Don't forget, you can call the show with a story or just a shout out. That number is 817-945-3828. You can follow the show, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can Periscope with us. You can do anything you want. Everybody have a good week out there. Do not work too hard. And
it's getting warm. Everybody be careful. It's getting hot.
Use your manners. If you're in traffic, you know, and somebody's wanting to come in the lane, let them in. What's it going to hurt you? I mean, don't cut anybody off. Hold the door for somebody, right? Pull out a chair for somebody. Stand up when somebody walks in the room.
Don't let them in. It was your. You don't got to let those people in.
See, listen, you're the problem.
They can get in behind you.
You're the problem.
You don't got to let those people in.
No, I disagree with Ken completely.
Yeah, it's hot, folks. Everybody, just make sure you don't get overheated. Even if you're out in your yard working or something like that, if you know some old people that maybe can't afford a lot of AC, maybe they don't want a fixed income or something like that, take them a fan. Go by and check on them. When it gets in this hot time like this, a lot of the shut-ins and stuff like that, people start dropping when it gets hot. We might make sure we got to check on everybody. I know that we do it around here. We have some people that we always drop by, at least for the people I work for. We drop by and check on folks from time to time just to kind of pop in, make sure everybody's doing good. Other than that, just folks, stay out of trouble.
Man. Have a good week. Go see Ant-Man.
Ant-Man was awesome. Yeah, go check out some Ant-Man. It was fun. And all you elitists, we'll talk to y'all on Thursday. Everybody else, we'll talk to y'all on Monday. Stay out of trouble. Have some fun. Give out a hug. Peace.
Get a good feeling, yeah.